to try to convince you in the next 15 minutes that the Hartle-Gell-Mann-style class operator framework can be applied and finds its natural home in loop quantum gravity. And I'm going to begin by giving you a little spiel on the philosophical side of science and of the specific problems of GR and quantum theory, then introduce the formalism of decoherent histories before applying it to loop quantum gravity. Now, the first thing to start with is to think about how do we normally predict things in a physical theory. Now, what usually physical theories do, they give us a certain number of paths, a set of paths in configuration space, also called histories. And then we get a probability distribution over those histories. And given that we know some initial segment of those histories, we can then assign probabilities for different ways things may go. Okay. Now, in a deterministic classical theory, the probabilities for things, for way things may go is either 0 or 1, right? Pretty simple. In a stochastic theory, this condition is relaxed, and we get a probability distribution that is non-trivial for the future. There are sort of non-trivial ways to assign probability to future histories, given that we know some initial segment of the history. So this is how prediction physics, in a sort of very, very canonical way, normally works. And now the game seems to, at first sight, the game seems to change in quantum theory. Because we know that due to interference, we can't just assign probabilities to just any history in the configuration space. And we all know this example. An example of the two-set experiment. If we know some initial segment, we cannot actually sum over the, we can't attach probabilities to each of those ways, each of those fine-grained histories. And we know, of course, this is due to the fact that we associate probabilities with mod squared amplitudes of the wave function, and this doesn't satisfy this equality. So what we need is we need to find a rule in quantum theory on how we can assign probabilities to histories. And now, the way this is done in Copenhagen or standard quantum theory is by saying, okay, we have a classical measurement apparatus. And this interacts with the system. And once we've measured the system either in the upper or in the lower slit, we can then assign probabilities to those histories. And everything works as it normally does. Now, this story is, things go wrong there for a host of reasons. And I can't cite them all. The only thing that is relevant in this case is that we can't apply this reasoning to a case where we want to look at a quantum theory of a closed system or of the whole universe. Because, of course, then we can't actually stipulate an outside classical observer, right? So this is, again, the quantum theory story in the Copenhagen style. But as I said, if we want to do this for the whole universe, it's not going to work out. Now, I should add a qualifier. Is Carlos still here? Right, so there are people who warn this. They say we shouldn't apply quantum theory to the whole universe. We would commit something like quantum tautology, from totos, everything, and the kind of double meaning there is intended. And I'm just going to bracket this and move on. Now, of course, the second challenge to quantum theory is well known, and this is what the whole conference, in a way, is about. We have a timeless theory of space and time. And quantum theory makes explicit reference to time. So there is a tension there. We have general covariance, Einstein equations transform covariantly under coordinate transformations, and physically meaningful quantities. So all of this is sort of reasonably crude. I'm just reminding you of this. Physically meaningful quantities are invariant under diffeomorphisms of the manifold. And in the Hamiltonian framework, we can say that the formalism of the constraint, the constraint system is frozen. Of course, on the other hand, quantum theory itself is defined to relative fixed background time, and in empirical reality, physically meaningful quantities do seem to depend on time trivially, and we do see things change. So we need to bring quantum theory closer to a timeless theory like GR, and reformulate it reformulating it in terms of histories does bring us closer to that. So this is the second motivation for looking at histories theory. in the Hartle-Gell-Mann framework. Right, so now let me look briefly at the formalism of Dickerson histories. Histories occur basically very straightforwardly from just looking at the general quantum evolution of a state in this way. Now what we can do is we can split up the evolution in basically a finite number of steps, and at each step introduce, insert a full set of projectors in this way, where the alpha k basically number the projectors for each of those k for each of those k steps. This looks like this. All of this is, you know, kind of straightforward. And then if we resum in a suggested way, we can get these terms. And these terms are basically what denote history that are specified by those properties alpha one, alpha n, which depend on how we have chosen those. A history, and if you sum up all of them, basically what you get back is the full quantum evolution. Now, of course, there are different ways in which you can choose those projectors. There is there are more fine-grained ways, there are more coarse-grained ways, depending on what you're interested in. And so in this way, we get a natural sense of a more fine-grained history and a more coarse-grained history. And if you take the steps n to infinity, basically what you get is the sort of typical Feynman path, and the sum becomes the sum of those histories. Right, so this is the natural way in which these histories enter into quantum theory. And in the Heisenberg picture, they look like this. And now what you can do is if you just let them act on an initial pure state, what you get is the sort of branch state vector, and there is no prior commitment implied here to any kind of interpretation of quantum theory. This is just the sort of typical framework, which Gell-Mann Hartle produced. And this looks like this. And now we can ask, for which of those class operators, which of those histories, can we assign probabilities to the system? And now, of course, as we've seen, the problem of quantum theory is measurement, is interference. So what we need is a measure of interference. This is given by the decoherence functional. On this formalism, what we can say is we can assign probabilities to exactly those histories for which interference is negligible. And negligible means it is smaller than anything we can pick up in the experiment. So this is what the decoherence function looks like. And if we have, in the most general case, we have initial states that are mixed states and the same final states, then we have this form of the difference functional, and you can actually write it in this more, in this way. And you can already see what you have here is kind of restricted path integrals, some sort of histories, in the way that, you know, you have a sort of physical transition between the initial and final states, and you only regard a certain subclass of these functions in time. Okay, I'm going to go quickly now. Now, you can generalize this for something like field theory. We all know these expressions. The only difference between this and this typical particle is that you just sum over a particular class of those histories that satisfy the properties that are listed in the alpha 1 to alpha n, which I believe it is alpha. And also, and this is what Hartle and Gell-Mann do, they generalize this to a putative quantum theory of GR. And in this case, the expression looks like this. Now, how can this be applied to gravity? So there are three things we need to do. We need to look at what are the fine-grained histories of our system, what are coarse-grainings, and what are coarse-grained histories, and the associated class operators, and what does the decoherence function look like? But how do we measure which histories we can assign probabilities to? Now, let me just compare this to single particle non-relativistic quantum theory to make this more clear. If we view the initial final state as basically just as
a sort of giving this the state space of the boundary state as a whole. This is the boundary state space. Finite histories are just given by the classical parts of the single particle in configuration space, each weighted by one of those terms, and the full physical transition between sort of on, associated with this boundary, i.e., with the initial and final state, which is given by the typical path interval. Nothing fancy happening here. And these states are Heisenberg states. Now, the good thing is, the interesting thing is, in covariant gravity, we have a perfect sense on what these, on how these concepts translate, how they map over. Boundary state space is just given by the kinematical Hilbert space of spin networks, spanned by the spin network. And now the fine-grained histories are basically just given by single histories of a spin network, given by a single two complex. This Kutukovitz is covered by representations of SU2, and the edges are covered by intertwiners. I've followed some notation here. The sigma is the coloring of the two complex, and the sigma B is the coloring of the boundary. And this, the C is basically this particular two complex. This is a fine-grained history. And this is just a product of the amplitudes. On one hand, for vertices, this is 2JF plus 1, and for each vertex. Now, the full physical transition is given by summing of all possible ways to color two complexes and overall two complexes. At least if some cylindrical consistency is satisfied, I think that was a paper by Carl and other people on this, but this is not relevant for this discussion. And then one more suggestive way to write this up is by looking at a boundary that is disconnected into two components, and then it takes a similar form to what we have here. But this is a special case, so there are boundaries that are not disconnected into two components. Now, we can coarse grain in the single particle monotonic quantum mechanics case by just looking at those histories that pass through a certain interval on the real line at a fixed time, and those which do not. What we basically do is we sum over all paths except for those that don't pass through this region. What we get is just this expression, sum over basically from, if this is the interval, we sum over all those histories, and then we integrate over this. Of this small interval. And here we can already say basically we coarse grain by imposing a particular condition on the bulk. And the bulk is basically the set of histories between initial and final state. And we put a condition on this, and what we do by imposing this condition is the coarse grain. Now, this is just a way to put this in a generally covariant way, but what you have to do is these properties themselves to be physically meaningful have to be generally covariant or diffeomorphism covariant. And of course, the problem here is that we can't really call it a sequence because there is no earlier than a later than. So this is a sort of general conceptual problem that we can come back to in the future. What you do in quantum gravity is basically you just impose a condition on the bulk. And this basically amounts to a restricted sum over two complexes and colorings of those two complexes between initial and final states. Okay, and of course the limitation of initial and final is also arbitrary because they could just as well be finite initial state. So again, here we have a restriction of bulk configuration. Now, what could cost grainings actually look like? 1 minute. You could coarse grain according to intrinsic and intrinsic curvature, only look at those that satisfy a particular values for this physical quantities. And this lends itself nicely to this formalism because we know that coherent states, we can talk about coherent states that are peaked on particular values of intrinsic and intrinsic curvature. They're encoded in SLHC labels for each link. And so we can coarse grain in this way. And the details of this are, of course, extremely complicated to work out, given that we have basically still very large sums in two complexes and colorings. Another way to coarse grain would be to look at those histories for which there is an intermediate state of some sort in which the volume operator, the spectrum of the volume operator satisfies a particular condition. For instance, it can be above or below a certain number for the volume. But this is actually pursued in a non-gravity context in Hartle and in recent head by Craig and Singh. Now, and the decoherence functional, this is the equation we saw earlier for a sort of in the most general form, is an expression that looks like this, where we have here again, this translates to something like this, where we have the transition amplitude associated with a two complex, where the coloring facing and edge coloring is given by this, and this boundary coloring, the sum of all those that satisfy the condition alpha, likewise here for the alpha prime, and then this sum is imposed by summing of the boundary colorings. Now this, of course, is still, as I mentioned earlier, currently exactly, we can't work it out yet. It's too complicated. This is a different point. It obeys everything we need to know about, everything we normally impose on the Decoherence functionals. This obeys by construction. Right, so we can't work these out yet. We've got a good handle on that. So what we need to do is we need to approximate, and this is how I interpret what is being done by people like Adotto in recent times. They basically have expanded, this is the interpretation of this transition amplitudes, that they expand in order of the vertex amplitudes. And sort of the speculation is that this basically is imposing a coarse graining and we can look at those histories by expanding the vertex amplitudes. And what they've done is they look at a very simple spin foam. This is the boundary, first of all, on which we have a coherent spin network. Coherent spin networks are those that are keep a particular values in extensive energy curvature. And what we then do is we expand this expression and we get, with some caveats, a trivial classical equation, Friedmann cosmology, but only for an empty universe that is like a fragile single volume. So I'm just going to end with putting up these major puzzles that I guess we all know about, that of course also with this whole program is contributing on these being resolved again. Thanks.
This is really just a comment for a question. This is long overdue. I remember so many years ago talking to Jim Harlow and saying that this formula should be applied to spin foams and spin networks. So thank you for starting. But having said that, it would be nice if you could use the formula. Having set it all up, it would be nice if you could use it to really make a prediction or solve a concrete problem that couldn't be solved in any other way.
Right. So I guess the problem is from just coming up with what are candidates for sort of quasi-classical realms, as Hartle put it, doesn't actually answer what they are and how we can get them. And so this is just the project of saying what are candidates for it, and then what conditions do we have to satisfy before we can even consider them to be quasi-classical.
Is it possible that this could be used to address a sort of very stubbornly persistent problem, which is how to derive new quantum technology from the more general spin foam models? Because you could break up into quasi-classical domains according to the homogeneous.
So the usual way this is done is those histories that to which you can assign probabilities are the ones that the session constraints are by quasi-classically. So you will get something, the expectation is you will get something like cosmology out. Loop quantum cosmology, I mean this, if you look at certain degrees of freedom, you can apply this to quantum cosmology. I would say yes. But this is, so the aim here is to basically go there from the full theory. It's already, I think that the people who do this, like Craig and Singh, they are doing this currently for loop quantum cosmology.
I see. Okay.
So this is a different, this is sort of, as in standard quantum theory, going from the most finite description of the system to the sort of quasi-classical realm.
any further question? Nothing, then let's thank you.
Okay, so our next speaker is Andreas Böhm, and he will tell us about the Topos approach to gravity.
Yeah, thanks, Philip, and thanks for the organizers for giving a radical like me the chance to present here. It's late in the day, and I hope the talk will be a little bit entertaining. I want to start with, well, that's the plan of the talk, it's pretty obvious. Start with a bit of motivation, and on the first slide I'll have a number of statements or slogans, if you like, and I hope you don't all agree with them, because then we have something to discuss later on. First thing is maybe not so problematic. So quantum gravity is obviously a problem in foundations of physics. Second point I want to make is why quantize? In this pair, quantum theory and general relativity, we have much more trouble conceptually with quantum theory. So quantizing gravity may be quite misguided, actually. Third point is about geometry, maybe less contentious. We clearly need some new geometric ideas. And they should not be based on continuum concepts. My claim is that non-commutative point-free spaces will be key tools, and we should look at these. The fourth point is logic. We need a formulation of quantum theory and then further theories like quantum gravity that can be interpreted in a realist manner without referring to measurements and observers. Even if you agree with all these things, you may probably not agree with this. My claim is this will not be achieved within a Hilbert space formalism. We need radically different mathematics to get a good theory of quantum gravity. And Topos theory can give us some ideas and some results in this direction. Now, more specifically, I want to talk about what we call the Topos approach to the formulation of physical theories. Of course, Chris Isham started this, as many of you will know, and then there was an early phase he worked with Jeremy Butterfield. I got into this in 2006, and a number of other people wrote down the names here. I didn't write down all the names of the PhD students working on that. The approach, and also this talk, are about the architecture of physical theories. It's not so much about models. There won't be any specific models discussed in this talk. It's really about a mathematical structure and interpretation of theories. And most of the work is actually not on gravity. It's actually on non-relativistic quantum theory. So it sounds a bit boring, but it's an obvious starting point to see whether this can work at all, and it's a testing ground. And I think it's very necessary to say that it's work in progress. So think of the Topos approach a bit like this. Now, I found this quote, many of you will know this, by von Neumann, actually quite early on. He said he doesn't believe in Hilbert space anymore. And I think going to quantum gravity should reinforce this. And he had two reasons for this. Hilbert space formalism practically forces what's called an instrumentalist interpretation upon us. So things like the Born rule, the Cauchy-Specker theorem, they're all hints. And basically what I'm saying, we have to talk about measurements and observers in a pretty fundamental way. It's hard to get away from this. And this makes no sense in theories like quantum gravity and quantum cosmology, where your system is closed and is the whole universe, because there's no one sitting outside performing measurements there. And the second point is that continuum ideas are built into our mathematical formulation of physical theories in a very fundamental way. So we use real and complex numbers, inner products, which basically give us angles and probabilities. We quantize algebras over smooth spaces, all that stuff. But all of us kind of believe that quantum gravity at the Planck scale will not have this continuum picture. So why should we use mathematics that fundamentally puts something in which we don't expect to hold? So the question arises, can we replace the Hilbert space formalism by something better? And that's actually a radical question, I guess. And that's why I said what I said in the beginning. Now, Let's step back and look at classical physics for a second, because that will be guiding us to a certain degree. Here on this slide, I'll have all you have to know about classical physics. So it's a cartoon version, but all the key points are there. And the structure of classical physics is that you have a state space or phase space. So when I say state space, you can think phase space if you prefer this. And physical quantities are represented by real valued functions on your phase space. And if you now look at some point S, you pick a state here, then the physical quantity has a value. And you simply evaluate this function FA at the point S, you get a real number. That's the value A has in this state. You can turn this picture around. You pick a subset of the real line. And you look at its inverse image under this function. This will give you a subset of your state space up here. And that represents a proposition about your system. The proposition is just physical quantity A has a value in delta. I write this symbolically in this way. And of course, the state assigns a truth value to this. If the state is contained in this subset, then the proposition is true. And if it's not contained, it's false. So the point I want to make, there's a link between geometry and logic. And of course, we can't naively go ahead and reformulate quantum theory in such a way, because the Kolchin-Speckle theorem tells us we can't do it. Now, one of the key insights that got the whole topos approach started was when Chris saw that we can replace this idea of having a state space as a set that we're all familiar with, by having state spaces in a generalized sense as objects in a suitable category. In classical physics, you would use sets, and actually nowadays in quantum theory, you also still use sets. But we think you should go to generalized spaces, which may not be sets anymore. And they are objects in a category, and this kind of category we suggest is a topos. So this is where this comes in. It's not easy to say in 2 minutes or even 15 minutes what the topos is, but this is where this comes in. The interesting aspect is you do not just get generalized spaces, you also get generalized logic at the same time. And this is something logicians have realized a long time ago. There's not just one kind of logic. You use a logic that is appropriate for your situation, and topos in particular has a built-in logic, and you can talk about things like partial truth in a topos in a systematic way. And these two things open up the way to reformulating quantum theory in a way that gives us, on the one hand, a new kind of quantum state spaces, on the other hand, a new kind of logic. So we get around the Kolchin-Speckle theorem in a certain way. Okay, but how do we do this, actually? So let's start from standard description. You have a quantum system, and you have it described by bounded operators on some Hilbert space. We look at something simple. We look at a commutative subalgebra of this non-commutative algebra of bounded operators. And such a commutative subalgebra is something we call a context, and of course, just given by a set of commuting observables. And since everything commutes nicely, you can interpret this as one classical perspective, one window on your quantum system. The idea, of course, is not to single out one context, but to keep all of them, use all of them at the same time, because that can give us a complete picture. And we formalize this the following way. You look literally at the set of all contexts. I write this V of H. And you partially order them under inclusion. You have smaller contexts, smaller abelian subalgebras, bigger ones. You just keep track. Here's an example. Think of a spin half system. There is a context that contains spin X and total spin. Let's call this Vx. And there's another context, Vz, that contains spin Z and total spin. They obviously intersect in some context that contains total spin. Now, the context category V of H keeps track exactly of these things, how contexts overlap, how they intersect. And note that in some indirect way, we relate these non-commuting physical quantities, spin X and spin Z. Even if we smash the whole non-commutative algebra into commutative pieces, we still keep a bit of information about the non-commutativity. Here comes the key definition. So I'm building up to this definition of the quantum state space. Each context, V, provides us with some notion of classical local state space. Local here just means at this commutative part of the big non-commutative structure. There's no space-time aspect to it. For those of you who know a little bit C star algebra theory, this is the Gelfand spectrum of the algebra. But if you don't know this, basically you get a nice compact Hausdorff space from a commutative algebra that we're looking at now. And moreover, the self-adjoint operators in the context give you real valued functions on this space. And that, of course, should remind you of this picture we already had. It looks exactly like what we had in classical physics. But that's all within one context. If you have now one smaller context contained in a bigger one, you get a canonical function from the space associated with the bigger to the space associated with the smaller algebra. And the key definition is here. It's actually quite simple now that we've seen this. I just look at, why is it vibrating? I look at the collection of all these local state spaces together with these functions between them. Mathematically, that's a pre-sheaf. You don't have to go into this at all. Just think of a collection of local state spaces together with these functions. And this guy is our quantum state space. It's not a set. Rather, it's a gluing together along these functions of all these local state spaces. And the first result in the whole approach, actually, that's really interesting, was this theorem. The Kolsch-Schmecker theorem is exactly equivalent to this generalized space not having any points, not having any global sections. So it's kind of a geometric reformulation of Kolsch-Schmecker, if you like. This doesn't mean that the space is empty, but it gives you an idea it's some kind of non-commutative space. It has no points. You cannot focus down to points. You still have things like subsets, but you don't have really small subsets just containing a point. And actually, the sigma is an object in a topos. This is where this comes in technically, and we will not need any details here. So I'll just mention this and then go on. But we had this idea that classically propositions correspond to subsets of the classical state space. And in a similar way, we get in our topos reformulation that propositions become sub-objects, which are basically like subsets of our quantum state space. So it looks like classical physics. And classically, the subsets of your state space form a Boolean algebra. This is where the logic aspects came in. What kind of logical structure do we now get for quantum theory? Well, it won't be a Boolean algebra. That's a bit too naive. But you get something that's called a bi-Heiting algebra. So probably haven't heard of these guys, but it is a generalization of Boolean logic that keeps distributivity, but you split the concept of negation into two things. That's actually quite interesting because it's much, much better behaved, the kind of logic that you get than standard Birkhoff and Neumann quantum logic where you give up distributivity. Okay, so what about states? Classical physics would say a state is a point in your state space, but I already said our quantum state space has no points. So we have to be pragmatic. We actually take a small subobject. We go as small as we can. We don't have points, but we go as small as we can. So we define these pseudo states, and there's a map. I had to take this out because I'm running out of time otherwise. I want to mention this for the German speakers who may appreciate this. This is a map delta we call Daseinization. I won't go into this, but it's a pun on the German word. Yeah. Okay, now in classical physics, when is a proposition true? If the state represented by this point of your state space lies in the subset representing the proposition. So we can read this as a logical formula. This is a logical formula. It's a Boolean formula. This can either be true or false. Either S is contained in there, then it's true, or not, then it's false. You can write down a very similar looking formula in the topos formalism. And you can interpret this as well, but you have to interpret it using the logic of the topos. And you do get a truth value, but now that's the truth value provided by your topos. And the topos has uncountably many truth values. And in general, you will not get totally true or totally false. Of course, it can happen. But in general, you will get something between true or false. So what is this good for? Well, in this topos formulation, every proposition has a truth value in every pure state. The truth values replace probabilities. So it's good that we have uncountably many of them because we have uncountably many probabilities. And crucially, the assignment of truth values does not refer at all to ideas of measuring and observing. So it really tells you how the thing is. It really tells you how the thing is if you accept that the logic in which we should talk about the quantum system is this richer logic provided by the topos. And this is why we call this a neorealist description. So this is how we get rid of the need using observers. And I have no idea how I'm doing for time, but let's just go on. So mixed states. I only talked about pure states so far, but what about mixed states? Classically, a mixed state is a probability measure on your state space. You know this from thermodynamics. And there's a nice result that shows that if your Hilbert space is at least three-dimensional, every quantum state gives you a probability measure on your quantum state space, but also the other way around. So you can say abstractly, start from a probability measure on my state space, and I get back a quantum state. And these measures can be used to calculate the usual expectation values, probabilities. You recapture the Born rule in this formalism. But interestingly, that's maybe half obvious by now, sigma, this generalized state space, is a joint sample space for all quantum observables. That's something, of course, not possible if you have a set. We all know that this doesn't work. But precisely because it's not a set, and precisely because it does not have points, you can have this. That's a joint sample space for all quantum observables. It was something that didn't exist before. And what about time evolution? Again, classical physics is our guiding light in this. Classical physics would tell you, well, you have to look at flows. These are one parameter groups of symplectomorphisms on your state space, so they preserve the symplectic structure. Nice. Kind of maps, but we can do something really similar. We can define flows on our quantum state space. Okay, it has no points, but that doesn't matter. We can still define them. It's a bit of work, but you can do this. And if you, for example, transport such a measure, this such a state, along with the flow, you get a Schrödinger type of picture. The state changes in time. Alternatively, you can transport these Clopen subobjects along with the flow. These are propositions about the values of physical quantities. That gives you a Heisenberg picture. So you can find this in this paper. I give the archive numbers. Of course, all the older stuff is in print, but it's probably easier to find from the archive. Okay, I'm almost done. Last thing I want to mention is physical quantities are also represented in a new way. Of course, classically, we had these functions from state space to the real numbers. And in a similar way, we get functions, which now are arrows in our topos, from our quantum state space to a space of values. That's not just the real numbers. That guy is actually a bit more interesting. It has the real numbers in it, but it also allows for what we call unsharp values. And those are quite simply real intervals. But that seems attractive for quantum theory. And let's summarize and then give a very quick outlook. So the slogan is, there is an alternate formulation of quantum theory. Basically, you rewrite it using structures in this topos, and things look very much like classical physics. Of course, there are differences, but structurally, things become closer. And this means we get around the Cauchy-Speicher theorem by taking the step from sets to pre-sheaves. We actually get a quantum state space. We get time evolution by flows, states, probability measures, and so on. Get a new form of logic that allows us to think in a realist way about our system. And the general structure is Hamiltonian, you could say, because you have the state space and flow picture, but the state space is a generalized non-commutative space. That's the key difference. And I think that should be very relevant in any kind of physical theory where you have to deal with non-commuting observables. The setup, of course, can be generalized well beyond what I've said here. If you look, let's say, like an AQFT has a setup of local algebras, they have space-time labels, and your context category would have additional space-time labels. And some steps were taken in this direction. And of course, it's not that the mathematics fixes everything. It is something you have to fill with life by physical insight. You have to pick the topos, you have to pick your state object. There's a lot of work to be done where you need physical insight. But it's giving you new structures that probably are very hard or impossible to see from the standard Hilbert space perspective. And here's, I'm actually interested in this. It's a rough conjecture. If you're a quantum particle flying through the world, you know, you're not perfectly localized. So maybe a good idea to describe your position in this object, which has these unsharp values as well, rather than standard R4. Now, the task, of course, or the challenge is to make this precise, work this out, define something like generalized metrics here, take a classical limit to R4, and so on. And I just want to note that this amounts to embedding space-time into a richer structure. And this is quite opposite to ideas of discretization that have been so much discussed here at this conference and elsewhere. Okay, thank you.
I was wondering if there's a way to see this as either a generalization of that picture or emerging from that picture.
Possibly, yes. I haven't thought about this, to be honest, but we do get things like Poisson brackets in this picture, and there's a lot of mathematics I was hiding, but when you talk about these flows, you look at generators of flows, and then they are basically Hamiltonians, but actually, okay, let me be a bit more precise. You get the usual self-adjoint operators, Hamiltonians generating flows, but you also get out a bit more. You get back a Lie algebra structure, take the commutator with the Hamiltonian. That's what you actually get out there. And then, so I can show this in some more detail. It's not obvious, but this comes from the mathematical setup and some things I couldn't present because time was short, but get out a lot of structure, and this spectral pre-sheaf is allows us to reconstruct all the relevant aspects of quantum theory and actually of the operator algebra we are looking at. That's a good question. I mean, whenever you use these operator algebras, you kind of suppress reference to units. But of course, we identify certain operators with physical quantities, position and momentum, let's say. And I think H bar comes in, but this has to be made precise, but I'm convinced it comes in precisely from this fact that our space has no points. So if you can squeeze it in some context, so to say, but then blows up somewhere else. And this trade-off should be quantified by H bar, so to say. It's a very intuitive picture, but that's where it will come in. Yeah.
So it's possible this is related to what you just said, but so you start off by saying that we should give up the idea of observables and measurements.
Observers and measurements.
Then, the classical theory, what you started with is observables being a commutative set. That's how we define classical physics. So you're still starting from the idea of observers and measurements.
Well, if you take a book on classical physics and look in the index, you will probably not find the words observers and measurements. And why is that? Because they do not add anything fundamentally to the theory. Classical measurement reveals a state of affairs that is there, but it doesn't add anything. And that's conceptually very different from quantum theory, where you have to talk fundamentally about the act of observation and observers not being quantum, extracting information from the system. All this talk about information kind of requires that you have two levels. And this is what we want to get away from. And I think this formalism can do.
It feels like that's still encoded in.
Okay, but you can, I mean, I'm not an operationalist, and you have to start, well, okay, the short and long answers, let me give two short answers. The first thing is you have to start somewhere, and you have to connect with an existing formalism, otherwise it's not a total bottom-up approach. You know, that's the one. And the other thing is that if you like operational arguments, then it seems to be a basic fact that we have only partial access in measurements to quantum systems. You cannot measure all things simultaneously. This is usually formulas for saying, okay, we have non-commuting observables, but you don't even have to go that far. Just say, okay, I really look at what can I operationally do? How many ways do I have to interact with my system? And then you basically arrive at the same structure without talking about non-commutativity directly.
So John Bell's view on the quotient spectrum theorem, and he was one of the first proving the theorem, was that it contained a very strong assumption, namely that if you measure a system in two distinct physical ways, you should get the same outcome And there's an easy way out. If you don't get the two same outcomes, you just say that the measurement disturbs the system. So it's sort of partex. And so there might be, so you put a lot of weight on the quotient spectral theorem, but it also might have a very classical, simple resolution. It's like, for example, you throw a die on the floor, and then you say, if I have two different types of floors, do I have to get the same outcome? And the answer is no, because it's two different physical operations you're making here.
Okay, let me be very brief on this. Of course, it's a question about should we allow for contextual theories, if I may rephrase this. Mm-hmm. And I am willing to argue with you and anyone else that a contextual theory makes no sense whatsoever. It kills any sensible definition of what even an observable is. Because if an observer, you say, I measure the same observable in two different contexts, but I get different outcomes. So in which sense is this even the same observable? Taking this seriously would kill the whole formalism of quantum theory as we use it, and that's so successful that we should at least try to preserve some aspects of it, even if object to others. But okay, you have to start somewhere. Yes, this is, it is something I accept and then put in. Yeah.
All right, let's thank the speaker again.
Well, the original title was Without the Frightening Thing, but I thought it was necessary to add. First of all, thank to the organizer for the opportunity to come here. It was the first time for me to visit Perimeter in Canada. Well, I hope it works. Yeah. Okay, so this is the outline, but I will start from the end, so at least no one will get disappointed that I am not in time to explain a few things at the end. So the basic ideology is a proposal for quantum theory coming from modular Tamita Takasaki theory that I did some time ago. Is based on the fact that quantum theory should be taken seriously and not come from a quantization of some classical things. And geometry usually is a prerequisite of quantum theory as it is expressed, usually at least in the time, is a classical variable that is used in quantum theory without any reformulation. But in reality, what I would like to know is that geometry is spectrally reconstructed a posteriori from operational theory of observables and states. How to reconstruct geometry? Well, there are several different notions of non-commutative space-times that you can use. But I make my preference in reference to Alencon non-commutative geometry as a possible context in which you can talk about non-commutative space-time, okay? So when I mean I want to reconstruct geometry from observables and states, I will reconstruct a non-commutative geometry in the sense of Alencon. Briefly, for the people that might have not heard in this conference, space-time is encoded through a spectral triple. So we have an algebra that is represented faithfully on a Hilbert space, and we have a Dirac operator that is encoding the metric and differentiable structure that has some specific commutator properties with the algebra. Every usual geometrical space, like a manifold, in particular a spinorial manifold, let's say compact spinorial manifold, is a special case of a spectral triple, but a spectral triple doesn't need to be based on a commutative sister algebra. There are generalizations of spectral triples that have been studied by the Australian group, mainly Kari, Phillips, Rennie, Sukuchev, that are adapted to modular theory. Why I need a non-commutative geometry adapted to modular theory? Because, in my opinion, my main suggestion is that Tomita Takesaki modular theory is the key element that allows you from an abstract formalism of operator algebra to abstract geometrical information. For those that might not know, Tomita Takesaki modular theory is a way to associate one parameter flow, a one parameter group, to a separating and cyclic state given a von Neumann algebra. So suppose that you have a von Neumann algebra on a Hilbert space and you have a cyclic separating state, you can automatically find out an evolution for it. So a lot of people are discuss about static dynamic, kinematic dynamic. Well, this kind of thing is essentially telling you that in some specific situation, you can get the dynamic from free, starting from a kinematical situation. This kind of thing has been used already in physics in the formalization of equilibrium statistical mechanics, equilibrium quantum statistical mechanics. So, but of course, in this context, it is in classical interpretation of quantum theory where you have a time parameter. What I would like to do is to use this kind of idea in a context that is covariant. This is more general situation in which you have not necessarily the algebra already represented on a state. What I will need is to have a categorical interpretation of covariance, because as I will explain in a moment, I will not get only one geometry. I will get a family of geometries that by the way, there will be geometry that describe not exactly space-time. They will describe a phase space. And I need a way to interconnect these different pictures. And category theory will be the way in which the principle of covariance is implemented in this kind of point of view. So what I did propose in the specific is to consider an algebra that for the moment I take to be a sister algebra, but this is a technical requirement that might be relaxed later on. So let's take a sister algebra of partial observables and consider a state over the sister algebra. Usually, especially for people that work in loop quantum gravity, several people have been studying the structure of Tomita Takesaki theory for the algebras of loop quantum gravity, and they didn't find anything because actually there are no good KMS states, but this is not a problem. Because there will be many, many, many subalgebras, let's call them local, for which this given state become a KMS state and for which there is a non-trivial modular theory. And this is not an exceptional thing. I mean, if you are used to algebraic quantum field theory, the vacuum state is not a KMS state. A lot of people have been talking here about black holes, about Rindler wedges, and thermalization of field theory. Well, the vacuum state is not a thermal state, but if you restrict to any open region that has a non-trivial complement, by Riesch-Lieder theorem, this vacuum state is automatically thermal, and there is a one-parameter group of automorphisms that come from Tomita Takesaki. The problem is that no one knows what does it mean, apart from very special region like the Rindler wedge that has been used all the time to formalize black hole thermodynamics arguments. The people that work in algebraic quantum field theory have these problems since a long time ago. They have plenty of regions that are not Rindler wedges, and this region have a non-trivial dynamic, and this dynamic is not implemented geometrically. And this dynamic should have a physical meaning. It's a natural one-parameter group that exists for every local algebra of operators in quantum field theory. If you want, the hypothesis is that you have to get rid of Minkowski space-time and reinterpret this kind of evolution on a different space-time that is non-commutative, on which it might make sense. So what I'm doing is that I take this KMS state over a subalgebra, and I use modular theory to construct a modular spectral triple. I get a Hilbert space that is just the GNS Hilbert space on which the algebra is represented. This one is just the unit vector that will be cyclic and separating. And K is the generator of the modular automorphism group. So it will be the modular Hamiltonian. And J is the operator that conjugate linear involution that implement the anti-automorphism with the commutator of the algebra. In this kind of approach, Tomita Takezaki modular theory is taking the role of Einstein equation, if you want. He is taking the state contains the information about the correlation inside the system. It contains the information about the matter content, if you want. And it associates a geometry. But this geometry that I create is probably too big to be the geometry of space-time. It's a geometry of phase space. As a few features you can already understand, this geometry is for sure non-commutative because these algebras are usually non-commutative. It's state-dependent. Every state gives a different geometry. And it is relative to observer. So every observer experiment the creation of a net of geometries. If you want, these are thermal geometries that exist in every system that can be formalized through operator algebras. We don't know exactly what these kind of geometry represent. Tentatively, one might try to think of this state as the covariant vacuum and H to be a boundary Hilbert space and this one to be a covariant constraint if you interpret this theory in a covariant context. For sure, these are space-time geometry that I would like to see as a kind of field theory that codify the interaction of the system, but it will not be a geometry of space-time. A few motivations from physics, quickly. What might be the reason why people need to talk about category theory in physics? Well, my main reason is that I have these big geometries that represent geometry on space, on phase space, and I would like to find a space-time that somehow justify the existence of these different geometries behind. Many people have been using category theory. Probably I have to remember that one at the origin of category theory, there are also some very physical considerations. Concrete category theory is essentially an extension of Klein-Erlangen program. So it is motivated by the notion of symmetry in space. It has been used already in algebraic quantum field theory. And there are several people that conjecture already how category theory can be used in quantum gravity. I want to concentrate mainly only on relational quantum mechanics from Carlo Rovelli. In 94, Carlo Rovelli elaborated a version of relational quantum mechanics in which the states are relative to the observers, and there is no real state of the system. The physical properties are due to correlation between different observers. And the physics is about information exchange between these agents, observer. And in 96, he made also a more interesting remark about the notion of relationalism and how this relationalism in the states is correlated with the general relativistic notion of localization in space-time. Similar ideas have been proposed also by people in algebraic quantum field theory like Rudolf Falk. Recently, he has been investing some time in trying to find out a version of relational space-time or emerging space-time. Well, the effort at this point is how to find the mathematical implementation of this idea using the sister algebraic formalism. Very quickly, what did I do recently was to use the sister algebraic formalism to extend the notion of higher category in a sister algebraic context. So probably most of you will be familiar with the notion of n category. It's just a set with a family of n operations that are associative and they have an identity, left and right. And satisfy a few axioms, but the main problem for non-commutative geometry is this exchange property that I can picture in this way. You can compose horizontally or you can compose vertically, and these are, for example, two compositions. If it is a two category, we have two composition. One is the vertical composition, one is the horizontal composition. And these two compositions satisfy usually an exchange law that allows you to do first the vertical composition and then the horizontal composition, or first the horizontal composition and then the vertical composition, giving you the same result. Well, this property is extremely problematic in the non-commutative geometric context because of this famous Ekman-Hilton argument. Automatically, it collapses all the structure to commutative sister algebras. I can make this other picture to formalize the context. For example, this should be a usual sister category with only one operation. If this one is one object, well, this will be the family of morphisms from A to A. This will be the family of morphisms from A to B, from A to B, and from B to B. These are sister algebras, and these are bimodules over the two sister algebras. And as you can see, in the case of only one operation, this can be a non-commutative sister algebra without any problem. Well, when you have more than one operation, the diagonal pieces of the hypermetrics that will come out are forced to be commutative, and this is a very big trouble for non-commutative sister algebra. So what I have been trying to do is to give a definition of a strict higher sister category that is listed here. There are exactly all the properties that you have in the sister algebra situation, apart from the fact that we eliminate the exchange property and we substitute with a functoriality that is described in this form. Well, this opened the way, in my opinion, for the discussion. Well, if you want some example, the easiest example that you can find is the version that comes from hypermatrices and hypersister algebra. You take a topolinear space with n operation and n involutions and n norms that are making every pair of operation and involution a sister algebra. The typical example, if you take an hypermatrix, a multimatrix of this form, and you introduce the line by column multiplication or the sure product, you can either take every family of multimatrix can be written in this form as a tensor product of matrix algebras, and you can choose the line by column multiplication or the sure multiplication on each one of the factors. Or you can choose the conjugate involution, transpose conjugate, or you can just choose the conjugate. And coupling together this pair of composition and involution, you get 2 to the power n different sister algebra structures. Well, what I propose to do, but I do not have time to finish to expose, is to use this kind of structure to formalize Carlo Rovelli's notion of relational quantum mechanics. So in this sense, all the different observers are formalized as hypersister algebras, and the correlation between two systems are formalized by suitable bimodules. So essentially the symmetries of a system are described, like, for example, in this way. If you have, like in algebraic quantum field theory, observable algebras that are related to different regions, you will have a bimodal that is just given by the twisting of one of the two sister algebras by the homomorphism. If you have localization, you will have, again, the same bimodal of twisting. And states and conditional expectation, they give rise to bimodals using the GNS representation and the Kasparov GNS representation in the same way. A physical system will be given by a sister category of correlations. And of course, you will be forced by the requirement by Carlo Rovelli that there is no difference between systems and observers. You will be forced to consider this one category that is describing a system, a physical system. You will be forced to correlate with another system, and this will force you to go up the ladder and reach two categories, three categories, n categories. And I suggest that this notion of n sister category is suitable for a description, at least at the topological level, of this formalism from Carlo Rovelli. In my case, this formalism is useful in order to describe how to possibly, in the future, collapse the structure of these non-commutative thermal geometries that are field theory geometries to a geometry of space-time. It might have an independent interest in quantum theory, for example, formalizing, weak measurements might be conceptually formalized in this way. When you want to get information on the wave function without influencing the system. Well, the time is limited, so I stop here because
how do you pick n?
No, there is no need to stop. You can go up the ladder to infinity, and if you want, you can truncate. If your problems does not require correlation up over a certain level, you can truncate it. But in principle, there is no reason to stop at n. Actually, stopping at n is always a problem because you have a border. You have to change the axiomatic of the category in order to adapt to the border. And it's actually easier to give the axiomatic for the infinite case.
Okay.
Any short question? That's not the case, then. Let's thank the speaker. And I guess now we come to the last talk for our session.
To practice the observable reaction.
Yes. Thank you, Philip, for organizing the foundation session. Now we come to one aspect of foundations of physics. It's not quite quantum, it's the foundation of quantification. So in theoretical physics, the term action is occupied by the mathematical notion action function. Only the notion of physical interaction makes unambiguous reference to a real network process between physical objects. What we are looking for is a strictly physical foundation of physics, where initially mathematics has to remain outside. And then every step where mathematics is introduced has to be justified. by abstraction. In that context, this covers a bunch of questions. What is the physical meaning of those mathematical operation symbols? For example, is the plus in 1 kilogram plus 1 kilogram the same symbol as in 1 second plus 1 second? To ask this question means to immediately recognize no. The association of weights is a different physical procedure than the concatenation of two operations. Similarly, the connection of two lengths requires Euclidean geometry as a physical theory, because one has to align two physical objects next to one another in an angle of 180 degrees. Such a specification of a measurement operation makes, of course, no sense in the case of operations. Similarly, one can ask, what is the meaning of the formation of proportions when we say force equals momentum divided by duration? Are we really dividing a momentum by duration? Of course not, that's nonsense. So one has to be clarity what it means to introduce those proportions. Similarly, physicists are combining different physical measures by multiplication. So what is the physicist really doing when he combines the mass with the velocity? And how is that related to momentum? One can ask that type of question for all mathematical operation symbols which we use in physical theory. And only that would we discover the problem of a strictly physical foundation of physics is a true problem on its own. Our problem is in that physical foundation approach, we are dealing with physical objects, and our problem is to determine the physical operations that physicists are doing in a strictly physical way. We talk about natural objects and about circumstances where we can meaningfully speak about notions like material objects and motion. For example, when we step into a billiard room, when the player, for example, makes the striking shot against objects balls, which are initially at rest, we realize that the cue ball at some point comes to completely to rest, and all the object balls are floating around widely. We can characterize we can physically describe those elementary collision interactions by physical attributes at the moment in a very pre-theoretic way. Namely, we can introduce the notion of the potential to cause action, something which we identify with energy. For example, we shoot the same cue ball once with high velocity and once at low velocity, or similarly, once a heavy cue ball and once a light cue ball against the same initially resting pile of object balls. We can compare the kinetic effect on how widely are those object balls flying around. And so on that level, one can introduce a pre-theoretic notion of what it means to be more or less energetic. In a similar way, one can determine the physical attribute of what is the momentum, what is it, the striking power of this object ball when it hits the object ball. Oops. In order to obtain a physical description of those empirical interactions, we construct a controlled replacement process where we have the same cue ball which will strike a pile of object balls, except that now the replacement process is controlled.
censorship. All right.
So instead of a generic collision of the cue ball against the object balls, we now have a collision where the process is controlled, and eventually from a reservoir of equivalent objects, a bunch of them will be kicked out of the reservoir. We will not be anymore addressed. And if all of them have the same velocity, we will represent the same striking power, and in a way also the each of those individually kicked out balls will also represent the same amount of energy. And in that way, we can start to quantify those formerly pre-theoretic attributes of what does it mean to be energetic or momentum. All that we do without presupposing any mathematics. So what we construct is a physical model for a calorimeter, where some generic object strikes in and hits a reservoir of equivalent objects, which are initially at rest, and eventually the incident object is absorbed, it comes to rest, and out of the calorimeter reservoir we can extract a number of objects which all have the same physical momentum and a number of sources of energy. What that means, we will see later. In order to understand how we can build a calorimeter and see how these pre-theoretic notions of energy momentum are quantified, we will assume that there are physicists who are performing those, who are controlling those replacement processes and who are steering the process in the absorption. So we assume that physicists have access to a reservoir of equivalent objects, and we assume that those objects can be subject to inelastic collisions. We don't presuppose what the spatial temporal structure of those inelastic collisions is. We just assume inelastic collisions are possible. Next, we assume that those inelastic collisions are also reversible, and now by associating or concatenating one inelastic collision with the inverse of its collision, we can compose the elastic collision. That's the same thing what Huygens once did in order to introduce the laws of momentum conservation for billiard balls. In much the same way, Feynman was also studying those inelastic collisions and composed of them elastic collisions in order to derive relativistic notions of energy and momentum. So we basically start from a very simple inelastic collision where two objects hit each other and stick together. When we combine them, we further assume the principle of relativity, where we can look at the same process from a perspective of a moving observer, and that guy will see the same elastic collision with the same objects. However, it will look like an elastic transversal collision where one object comes in and bounces off with the same magnitude of velocity, but rotated by an angle, and some incident object bounces off antiparallel. Once we have many of those elastic transversal collisions, we will eventually be able to construct a replacement process for the elastic longitudinal collision of between generic objects. And here we will obtain the first kinematical prediction, something which we did not presuppose before. In the beginning, we just look at inelastic collisions between equivalent objects, and by symmetry, we must occur in a symmetrical way. Otherwise, it would violate the principle of sufficient reason. But now we eventually come up with a replacement process which predicts exactly under what circumstances, say, an objects of different masses, what mass is,
I see, we will also see behave. Once we have those elastic longitudinal collisions, we can construct the absorption of a generic part object in a calorimeter, and in doing so, we can count what is the calorimeter extract and interpret that physically. So yeah, the standard interaction, the inelastic collision we assume is just we assume that the physicists Alice and Bob have access to a reservoir of equivalent springs and equivalent objects. How can we assure that two objects have equivalent dynamical equivalent momentum behavior? We just collide them against one another, and if none of the objects overruns the other, we know that we represent same inertia. Similarly, how can we control if he has access to several springs? It's just one example. That those springs are equivalent, he just releases the energy of those springs and looks at the kinetic effect if those standard objects are kicked away from one another with the same magnitude of velocity, that's the principle of equipollence, which was once introduced by Leibniz, when he knows that we both initially represented the same potential to cause action, the same energy. We assume that those standard interactions are reversible. So if we have antiparallel particles kicking in into a relaxed spring, which at the moment has no energy attributed to it, then we will slow down, and in doing so, the spring will be compressed. And in that state, say if we lock the spring, then we have generated a standard source of energy. If we take such an inelastic collision and concatenate it with the inverse of it, then we get the composite, which is an elastic collision. If Alice is doing the composition, if Bob is looking at the same interactions of Alice from a car which is driving by with exactly the velocity of the horizontal component of those incident objects, then he will see that process as an elastic transversal collisions, where one object with high velocity comes in and gets a tiny kick, and the impact particle is bounces off antiparallel with same momentum in the opposite direction, and that guy flies off with a small change in orientation. So those elastic transversal collisions we can set up with any velocity and with any angle. That's just the assumption of symmetry. That does not presuppose any mathematics. And by suitable and by the principle of relativity, we can always prepare suitable transversal collisions quantify what the magnitudes are. Once we have those transversal collisions, we can construct an impulse reversion process. We want to construct a model for a calorimeter. So suppose we have an incident object, and Alice has access to a reservoir of her dynamical measurement devices. She can generate transversal kicks, where each of them will stir around the motion of the object until it flies off with same velocity into opposite direction. Similarly, if we have an incident object of same inertial behavior but with different velocity, with a higher velocity, then if, say, Bob would mobilize the same energetic sources, those compressed standard springs, to stir around the impulse reversion of that high velocity incident particle, it would take him more of those transversal kicks. The kinematics of the angles and the velocity dependent, all that one can straightforward derive from the basic assumption of how inelastic collisions behave symmetrically and the principle of relativity. So we have we can construct impulse reversion processes, say for an object which comes in from the left, which is sticked around, And we can also construct impulse conversion processes for an object which comes in from the right with lower velocity. The fast particle requires more kicks, the slower one less. And we can align those processes in such a way that the energetic sources which Alice's team of physicists has to mobilize in order to stir around the particle, and which Bob's team of physicists has to mobilize, exactly aligned anti-parallel, that allows them eventually to recycle their units. So here we have we have constructed a replacement process where a fast object comes in from the left and rebounces antiparallel with same velocity. Similarly, two slow objects come in from the right, that one, and we also bounce off antiparallel. And all the dynamical units which are expanded in the middle, we will cancel out each other. And that's why we don't need to worry about what are the dynamical details. So that process can be generalized to an arbitrary large number of particles. And if we refine the construction, then we can construct a replacement process where one unit object comes in with n times velocity and a composite of n objects comes in with a standard velocity. And eventually, we obtain one basic kinematical law of the elastic collision of generic objects, namely one which represents n times the inertia of the other object. So that's something which we didn't put in. That's a mathematical result about classical dynamics, which we didn't put in by hand, but which we just obtained from the underlying physical and methodical assumptions. Next, if we take those elastic longitudinal collisions, we can again look at them from the perspective of a boosted observer. And that allows us to construct the model for the calorimeter. Suppose we have, that's the incident object which will strike into the calorimeter. Then so with those elastic longitudinal collisions, we know how we behave in the center of mass frame. And from a boosted perspective, we can transform such that the fast incident object comes in from the left and bounces off antiparallel with reduced velocity. And at each step of bouncing off, the velocity will be reduced by the same amount. So we get a linear relation of how much, of how the momentum will be reduced after such a longitudinal kick. And similarly, the incident object, if we have initially a reservoir with n resting objects, which are initially at rest, after that elastic collision, we will bounce off antiparallel, all with the same velocity. And we can compose those processes such that we have one incident object with a high velocity which strikes into initially 9 resting objects of the reservoir, and it after that elastic longitudinal collision it will lose two units of standard velocity, and those initially resting reservoir objects will be kicked into motion with the same factor, and then we just let the incident object oscillate from the left to the right side. Now on the right side, it doesn't come in anymore with 10 times velocity, but only with 8 times the standard velocity. So here we need not 9 objects to bounce it into the opposite direction, but only 7. And those 7 objects will also be kicked out of the reservoir with the same quantity of motion. And successively, the incident object bounces to the left, to the right, to the left, and to the right, and comes to the rest in the calorimeter, while we can extract as a consequence of absorbing that object which has 10 times velocity, that object comes to rest. We have to mobilize initially 25 of those equivalent objects in the calorimeter, here 9, here 7, here 5, and here 3. And then we can sort that we have 10 pairs of antiparallel recoil particles, like the 9 splits into 7, which get kicked out to the right, and 7, which get kicked out to the left, etc. And there's also always a surplus of kicked out particles, and those ones, those antiparallel pairs will represent units of momentum, of energy, and those ones will represent units of momentum. So here we have the absorption of one object with a high velocity which comes to rest, and we can absorb an object with arbitrary velocity, up even in a relativistic case, and we always determine the calorimeter extract in terms of a number of those sources which represent units of energy, and those equivalent objects which always represent units of momentum. So then one can describe that the incident object has equivalent energy and momentum like as the calorimeter extract. We count how many of those energetic sources are extracted and how many momentum sources. That allows us to quantify the momentum of the incident object, and that we quantify the momentum as the momentum of those standard objects which have unit velocity and the pure number. That's the first time when numbers enter the game. Similarly for energy, the energy of the incident object and the energy of those units and the number, and eventually we obtain a quantification of the energy and momentum of the incident object in terms of physical quantities. So that construction is based not on mathematical presumptions but on physical principles, like most notably principle of inertia, impossibility of a perpetuum mobile, etc., but also on methodical principles. One of them is the congruence principle. If we want to have reliable quantities, then we want to make sure that each unit of momentum which is extracted out of the calorimeter is exactly equivalent to one another, and then we just need to count and can say how much momentum was extracted. In this way, we obtain fundamental equations. So we, in the calorimeter, we can individually count how many energetic units are extracted, how many momentum units, how many mass units are involved, and how many, and if the velocity, what multiple of the unit velocity is represented. And then in this way, we discover fundamental equations. Like we can independently measure the energy as a multiple. That's a pure number of the energy of the unit, which are all, those units are all equivalent to one another. And by looking into the construction of the model, we can see that the number of energy corresponds to exactly that mathematical term. Similarly for momentum, one can do the same thing. One can construct the same model under Poincaré kinematics and gets relativistically corrected terms without presupposing it in the first place. And in doing so, we obtain quantitative equations as a result of those physical models. I'm wrapping up. That's my last page. At the end of the day, that calorimeter model represents a measurement and a steering tool. That's something which is artificial, something which we didn't presuppose, which doesn't come for free. There's an effort to come to it. And in the end of the day, we can deal with three sorts of physical interactions. Namely, we have that elementary standard interaction with the charge spring, which is releasing its energy, its potential to cause action. And we just take those standard actions. We haven't quantified them, but all we know is that those but standard action, they're all equivalent to one another. But then we can assemble them into layers. We can compose them with the inverse. We can build, by relativity, we can construct transversal collisions. We can construct longitudinal collisions and eventually build a model for absorption, which gives us a quantification of energy momentum. And now we can take that measurement device and couple it into any other type of physical interaction, for example, into a gravitational interaction. That's a picture of solar system. And if you are curious, what is the energy and the momentum of, say, Mars? We are here. That's Mars. So we just take that calorimeter, at least in Gedanken, and let Mars absorb, come to rest, and count how many, and now comes the thing, how many congruent units of energy momentum are extracted. That gives you reliable numbers. And similarly, you can also, that's how we quantify the energy momentum in quantum mechanical directions. Say, that's a picture of LHC, the Jura, the Alps. And if you have one particle jet and you want to know what is the energy and the momentum associated to it, yeah, you just use a calorimeter. So here, yeah, that eventually shows that by starting, that is my last picture, that by starting from empirical, that by starting from empirical practice, there's no mathematical assumptions involved. We introduce physical meaning by introducing a pre-theoretical ordering relations for energy and momentum, objects overrunning one another or overrunning not doing so, then we build physical models, which all consist of congruent unit actions. So those models don't come for free. There's Alice and Bob who make an effort. But once we have the model constructed, those physical measures will be turned into quantified physical measures. And the same energy of those objects now is expressed as the energy of a standard reference and a pure number. And that pure number, that's the first time where mathematics enters the stage. Here we encounter basic physical quantities, which are not defined by equations, which are obtained by a practical exercise. And once you have them, you can look into the structure of those physical models, may it be classical, may it be relativistic, and look what those individually measurable quantities, what relations we satisfy, and now you obtain quantitative equations without presupposing them, and then you can introduce derived physical quantities, look, and eventually use the machinery to derive the principle of least action. So it gives the complementary account on how we normally do theoretical physics. It's from the bottom up. Thanks for your attention, and thanks for it. How many different types? Thanks for the question. That brings me to my favorite slide. Yeah. So how many different? So that question refers to the. It was mentioned Erlang and Felix Klein, the place of the Erlang school of arithmetization of geometry. But there was another Erlang school in philosophy of science, and that became influential, at least in German-speaking community, from the 50s until, say, from 1950s until 2000, and that goes under the name protophysics. When you ask how many different physical theories fit into that scheme, you can reflect, what do all those physical theories have in common? For example, here we assume the elementary standard interaction of a spring without specifying the processes within the spring. We just look at the spring at the compression and the expansion of a spring as a completed process and compare initial and final state. If the processes inside the spring are of a quantum mechanical, of a field theoretical nature, it all doesn't matter. We just take it as a unit. But once we have those units, and once those units are reproducible everywhere, anytime at an arbitrary number, we can build those measurement devices. And utilize them to specify any other type of interaction, for example, gravitational interactions, quantum mechanical interactions, all other physical theories. That's the protophysical character of that construction, or that's the protophysical character of basic dynamical quantities, energy and momentum. All those other physical theories have in common that there's momentum conservation, and there's conservation of energy, and eventually we describe them all by means of an action principle. The origin of those protophysical principles, which kind of constitute every physical theory, those do not come from any specific assumption, but they come from the underlying physical principle, which, like here, the impossibility of producing a perpetuum mobile. That's the principle on how you construct machines, measurement devices, and how you utilize them. From those pre-theoretic physical principles, that's what eventually gives rise to those basic notions of dynamics, and basic measures of energy momentum. Once we have them, then we can enter the next level of physics and actually physically determine other interactions in terms of energy and momentum, which we couldn't before. So that's the man-made contribution in physics.
Okay. We're half an hour late, so I think